Good morning. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Blackwell 21st Century, and still for a while distinguished lecturer at York College City University of New York, welcoming you to this June 4th edition of Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. That's the York College radio station. Woo, graduation was on this last Friday. It was great to see all those students, 1,206, graduate. What a glorious occasion. And I was there to witness that. It's a part of my exit from York College. So I have a little time left yet. So we'll be Professor Distinguished Lecturer Emeritus. Well, maybe we'll just hang on to that handle. Anyway, today's show, first of all, taking your lead from our chief announcer, I want to thank everybody who contributed to the pledge drive. You still have an opportunity, however, to, if you have not become a sustaining buddy, and certainly we on Vantage Point have been in the forefront of pushing the idea of you becoming a sustaining contributor for just $10 a month, $120 a year, you can become a sustainer of WBAI, which is incredibly important, particularly given the kind of discussion we're going to have today around a number of issues, including the Poor People's Campaign and the fratricide murders in black communities and what can we do about it. Oh, we have in-depth conversation. I was on a radio station the other day from out in Denver, Colorado, and, you know, they wanted to have a conversation about reparations in 12 minutes. It was a joke. It was really a joke. It was a commercial stand. 12 minutes? What can we talk about in 12 minutes? And so I just wanted to say how incredibly important it is to have this medium where we can have in-depth conversations in a way we just can't have in commercial media. So we can really, really, really get it done. So by credit card or savings account, just $10 a month, you can do more, $25, $50, $100, whatever you can do. I'm a WBAI buddy, proud of it. I don't know anything about it. It just happens because it comes out of my credit card. You can do that by going to give to WBAI.org, give to WBAI.org. Well, today's show, we are hoping to have none other than the Reverend William Barber join us momentarily to talk about the vision and mission of the Poor People's Campaign, one of the most, well, Reverend Barber is the leader of what I consider one of the two or three most important movements in this period, without question, the Moral Monday movement that is now spread and developed into this massive movement across the country, and part of which now is the Poor People's Campaign. We'll have Reverend Barber on, and literally on the bus on their way to Albany, New York, is a contingent from the local Poor People's Campaign with Reverend Clyde Cumberly and Claudia Dela Cruz. We're going to be checking in with them as they are actually riding up to Albany for today's action. And then a topic of grave concern in our community, even though the crime rate is dropping and the murder rate is dropping, there's still too many these crazy killings inside the black community. Earl Afari Hutchinson is going to be joining us because he had one of these occur right in his neighborhood. I actually had one in my neighborhood too. And it is a cause of great pain in the black community. So our conversation is going to be fratricide and murders. Do black lives matter to black people? And we want our audience to weigh in at the end of the show on this topic. Do black lives matter to black people? Earl Afari Hutchinson. And then one of the great success stories in this country, in the city and the country, is the work of Man Up Incorporated in East New York. And, of course, we're going to talk about, have a segment with Andre Mitchell, who is on his way back from, and will be joining us. He'll be landing and joining the conversation at the end. And then we will be plugging you into the conversation by way of telephone with our listening audience at the very end of the show. So we're waiting to hear from you in that regard. And so, again, we want to talk about the Poor People's Campaign today because it is, again, one of those incredible movements and an incredible moment in American history. And we're waiting to see whether Reverend William Barber will be joining us momentarily, we hope. But in any event, just in terms of background, as we look at the Poor People's Campaign, and for this generation, it's incredibly important because this generation has not experienced the Poor People's Campaign. Those of us like myself are familiar with it because I was very much involved in this period of history. But at the end of his life, Martin Luther King was working on a Poor People's Campaign. Actually, those last 2 years, 1967, 1968, here in 1967 at the Riverside Church, of course, he began to move in that direction with his serious, sharp critique of the war in Vietnam, but more than the war in Vietnam, a critique of the capitalist political economy, its failings and its shortcomings as related to black people, minorities, but poor people and working people in this country. And he was making that shift, probably already gestating throughout his life, throughout his advocacy, to begin a frontal assault on this system. One of the more memorable quotes that I use very often, I used it in my final address, my final speech at York College, is true compassion is more than flinging a coin at a beggar. It comes to understand that the edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. I mean, that's systems change. That's not tinkering around the edges. And so, at the end of his life, as Martin Luther King went to Memphis, he was actually planning a Poor People's Campaign that was to deal with the issue of eradicating poverty in these United States of America. Now, that's a tall order. And, of course, in and of itself and by itself, you know, one wonders whether or not that was an immediate accomplishable goal, but it certainly was one that was designed to organize the masses to address issues of inequality, of poverty, in the midst of plenty, in the wealthiest and most technologically endowed nation on the face of the earth. And so, unfortunately, King, as we all know, did not make it in terms of finishing this last it ended up being his last campaign. We know where it ultimately would have led. But one of the things I continue to remind our audience of is that what was really radical about it, which is now being discussed again, frankly, in lots of different quarters, even in some conservative quarters, frankly, is the notion of an economic bill of rights, an economic bill of rights. That was the focal point, really, of the Poor People's Campaign. And by the way, what was envisioned was that literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people would descend on Washington, D.C. And that actually did happen. It happened without King. And there was a Resurrection City set up on the Mall, in the National Mall in Washington, D.C., to call attention to the plight of the poor. But, of course, without Martin Luther King, it just did not have the power that it would have had he lived to be at the forefront of this effort. But what's most important conceptually is the idea. And that is the notion that a economic bill of rights, which is something, frankly, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had talked about in his concept of the four freedoms, an economic bill of rights, to say that in this society, there should be a guaranteed annual income, a floor beneath which no one should fall. That concept is being talked about. In fact, I think it's Cory Booker and a couple of other people may actually be introducing a piece of legislation in the Senate of the United States on that level. Now, unfortunately, you know, we on the left sometimes can't get along. So there are some people saying, well, that doesn't deal with the issue of stagnation of wages. Well, the two are not mutually exclusive. I mean, this is what my argument is with the progressive movement. We are either or ideologues. I'm the other way around. I tend to look at things in terms of synthesis. How do we combine ideas as opposed to see them as being mutually exclusive or antagonistic to each other? So guaranteed annual income. The other concept is housing. We know we have a hell of a problem with housing right here in this city, affordable housing, all across the country, primarily because housing has been privatized. And so now you have to negotiate with the private sector in order to get affordable housing. You know, at least in the heyday of the Great Society programs of Lyndon Baines Johnson and others, you had massive public housing. And by the way, well, I'll come back to the jobs thing in a minute, that everyone would be guaranteed an affordable, quality living dwelling. Health, that's right, health care, guaranteed health care for all Americans, everybody. And finally, education. These four key areas would be guaranteed for every citizen in these United States of America. Now, what that would require really would be massive investment, and it would require massive public expenditures, and inevitably that would require that those who have would have to contribute more. And so therefore, obviously, there would be resistance to that, because in this current period, what we're seeing, of course, is again, a situation where, you know, there's this trickle-down economics. There's really an outright war on the poor. This administration, you know, arguing simply that by an expanding economy, everybody will do better. And to some extent, there are some signs that that is to some degree true, but doesn't take into account people who are still looking for work. It doesn't take into account part-time workers. It doesn't take into account what we call underemployment, where people, in fact, actually don't have sufficient income, have to work two or three jobs and things of that nature in order to be effective, actually, in terms of have a quality life. And so the idea, again, of this Economic Bill of Rights, and Jesse Jackson Jr. actually picked up this cause when he was in Congress, put out a book about it. But it's important to me because people have forgotten that. It's not a part of the discourse. It's not a part of the discussion in terms of what is going on vis-a-vis goals and objectives. And so for me, you know, we need to be bold in this moment, bold and visionary. Is an Economic Bill of Rights likely to happen right now? No. But the point for me is not whether it happens right now. The question is to put it out there, to, in fact, to articulate it in a way that helps to galvanize, first of all, to people, put it in people's imagination, to have people conceive it, to have people believe it. And that's where we are now, and having people to understand that it is possible if we organize and mobilize, march on ballot boxes, do economic sanctions, do a range of things, we can make this happen. And that's why I think the work of Reverend William Barber in this era, in this period, with the Moral Monday movement, in which he's casting this not as a Democratic struggle, not as a Republican struggle, not as liberal or conservative, but as a moral struggle. That is to say, what is the moral commitment? What is right? Now, of course, that's debatable, because there are people on the right who argue that this ain't right, you know, and so that's debatable as well. But it's a perspective to frame it in moral terms. What ought to be that which all human beings are entitled to? That's a good framework, and we can debate that. Are we saying that every human being ought not to have quality education, housing, health care, and a job? Well, some people will say, yeah, they ought to have that, but it ought to be, you know, in some free market system where it's minimum wage, and in situations where people are actually forced to be in unsafe working conditions where there's no regulations. I mean, that's the capitalist market system pushing back, because it is the capitalist market system is an amoral system. It's not immoral. It really actually ends up being immoral, at least in my judgment, but it's amoral. It does not pretend to do the right thing. It does not pretend to be moral. It says that it will work in order to create some jobs and benefit some people. And the way it functions is it tends to benefit those who have, and those who have get more and more and more and more. That is the way it functions. And those of us who believe otherwise say that that is not only amoral, it is immoral. And so that is the great contest. That's the great contest. That is why a Moral Monday, Poor People's Campaign framed in these terms becomes incredibly important, because it is about really this heart and soul. It's really about people's hearts and minds, but it's also about the soul of this country. It's the ongoing struggle for a more perfect union, if you will. And we've got to be involved in it. We've got to be involved in it. And we cannot be spectators. That is the one thing that those who have a different perspective count on, being spectators, us being non-participants, us being so apathetic, so hopeless, so alienated, so apathetic that we just, as Malcolm said, suffer peacefully. It's like having that Novocaine. We just accept it, or think nothing can be done about it, or I have mine, and if they don't have theirs, it's fine, and this is somebody else's struggle and whatnot. No, this is our struggle. It is a we, us, and our proposition. We are all engaged in it. And again, that's why what Reverend William Barber is doing is so incredibly important. It looks like Reverend Barber, whom we had confirmed, we thought, for the show this morning, is actually apparently not going to connect with us this morning for whatever reason, but that's okay. You know, we'll hopefully have him back another time. But I did want to give that kind of overlay in terms of not so much the specificity of this particular campaign, but the possibilities of a Poor People's Campaign as initially envisioned, and why picking up on that idea in this period is important, because we are in a tremendous struggle for the heart and soul of this country, and for our own souls, really. And we dare not lay back. We dare not, and for all of the protests, all of the moaning and groaning, complaining about what we see will be for naught if we do not act, if we are not engaged seriously, you know, in moving forward. So what I'm going to hope for now is that, again, we have a contingent of people who are actually en route to Albany for a action, and we're hoping that the Reverend Clyde Cumberley and Claudia De La Cruz, as we connect with them, will be able to just share their vision for what's happening, why they're connected with the Poor People's Campaign, and why they see this as being an important action. So we're going to reach out now to them. They're literally on a bus en route to Albany, New York, and we'll have a few minutes to talk to them and maybe get a shout out from those who are on the bus, because that's our segment. That's what we wanted to do today. It won't be the last time we talk about the Poor People's Campaign, but certainly if you don't know about it, you should know about it, and you should be engaged in it. Churches, civic groups, fraternities, sororities, and if not this, something. Right? I mean, if this is not the movement you want to be involved in, be involved in a movement. It's like Kwame Ture always says, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, the people must be organized. And absent that organization, we are like sheep. You know, it's democracy, and we're like sheep, so where we're not actually, you know, like fighting for our, we're just passively, you know, sitting back and accepting that which we ought not to accept. I mean, remember Jack O'Dell from the Rainbow Coalition. He's one of the great. He was an advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King, right? Dr. Martin Luther King. He said, I'll never forget that. In fact, he wrote a slogan. We organized something around. He said, the people organized is democracy's greatest guarantee. The people organized is democracy's greatest guarantee. And so the people, we must be organized. And that's one of the reasons why WBEI is important. That's why this show, I hope, is important. Because I'm always about stimulating activity. I mean, I am on the move. I mean, my retirement was only from York College City, University of New York. It is not from the movement. I tried to make that clear. I will be more busy this month than any month I can recall in recent times. On the move, working, organizing, encouraging, cajoling, twisting arms, pushing people to get engaged, to be a part of a movement, you know, in order to change the life that we are facing and our circumstances. So I hope we have now connected with our guests who are on their way to Albany, New York. They are part of the Poor People's Client Campaign. Do we have Reverend Clyde Cumberly on the line? Reverend Cumberly? Reverend Cumberly? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, Reverend Cumberly, do you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear just barely.
Okay, all right. I don't know why that is.
Well, that's because we just arrived in the bus. I just got off the bus in Albany. I'm standing out on the street right now.
Okay. All right. Well, we just have a few minutes. We just have a few minutes. Can you hear me better now?
A little, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Reverend Cumberly, and I know you're with also Claudia De La Cruz. So tell us.
Correct.
Tell us what your role is with the local Poor People's Campaign.
Well, my particular role is with the faith cohort, rallying people from all religious traditions to participate in the campaign.
Okay. And from your perspective, why is this campaign important, and what are some of the local actions that are being planned?
Well, there are local actions 3 days a week, plus the action in Albany on Mondays. Why I in particular have joined, and why I'm asking other faith leaders and members of their congregations to participate, is, as you, I don't know what Reverend Barber had to say, because we couldn't get a connection to listen, but I want to change the moral narrative specifically. We've accepted ideas of things from our leaders, ideas like limited resources and that racial and ethnic disparities are fact. We've accepted the idea that greed and avarice and war are natural human activities and behavior. This is all to me, nonsense and nothing like what our Creator has ever expected of us or wanted us to do.
Okay, and so in terms of the actions that you're taking in Albany, what are the specific goals? What actions are you taking, and what is the objective? What is the agenda for the campaign in New York from your perspective?
Well, again, I don't know what Reverend Barber had to say to you, but we have actions in each week in 39 state capitals around the country. That's a huge number for an organization that just beginning, and also in Washington, D.C. And in each one, we are literally at the state capitol. And each week we have specific goals and a focus that we talk about, and there is a rather large contingent of people who commit to civil disobedience and who have been arrested every week of the campaign across the country.
So in New York, and today's action, what is the focal point of today's action then? What's the goal for today?
I'd love for Claudia to give you that, and then I'll come back. Okay. I'm going to put her on right now, Reverend Claudia.
Reverend Hello. Claudia?
Yes, hi, how are you?
Fine, fine. I didn't, Reverend Coomerly didn't give me the reverend handle, so I didn't know you were a reverend, but that's good.
Well, I am a reverend, and I'm pleased to speak with you.
And so what is the goal and objective? And I understand you're on the national board. And by the way, we were not able to connect with Reverend Barber for whatever reason. He had confirmed, but I don't know if he's very busy, so we didn't connect with him. But what is, I understand you're on the national board?
Well, I'm part of the National Steering Committee for the Poor People's Campaign, the National Call for Moral Revival, and I'm also the co-chair for the New York State. I've also been involved in some of the New York City organizing. And so today, I'm pretty sure you know that for the 40 days, we will be engaging in different actions, and every week has a different theme. The theme of this week is around our right to health care and healthy environments. And so today we'll be engaging in non-violent moral direct action here in the Capitol, along with other 39 states that are engaging in coordinated efforts. Some folks will be risking arrest. Last week we had 28 folks that risked arrest and were actually arrested for a brief period of time while also protesting the war economy and militarism that the United States government has been engaged in, also causing the ecological devastation that we're calling to attention this week.
And as you see this moving forward, this is obviously a very critical period in American history. How do you see this playing out in terms of people's civic engagement, particularly in terms of their electoral involvement? At the end of the day, civil disobedience is one thing. Are people being registered to vote?
I think that's been one of our focus, the right for folks to access voter registration. As you know, there's been a lot of suppression across the state as a way of impeding folks' right to access and vote, but also deepening, I think the process of the Poor People's Campaign is deepening folks' understanding of politics beyond the electoral portion, the importance of movement building that holds politicians accountable. The importance of building people power in local communities and you know, also how we break the boundaries that are created by politicians that do not support or work on behalf of our interests. And so there is an effort to promote, you know, our right as citizens to vote and also our right to organize ourselves and build a movement that holds politicians accountable.
So there are 40 days, and is there a culminating event at the end of the 40 days?
Yes, we're going to be gathering in D.C. on June 23rd. It's going to be a massive gathering. We're hoping to have the different states that have been involved in the campaign, which are 30, at this point are 40, including Washington, D.C., come together in the D.C. area across issues and across racial lines to put forth and make it clear that this is a multi-year campaign and that it is beyond the 40 days that we plan to do more action and that what we are calling for is a transformation of the entire system that creates the conditions of poverty, of war, of death that a lot of the people in this country are experiencing and a lot of other folks across the globe are being imposed and forced to live in because of our government's decision.
So again, so the 40 days is just a marker, but the idea is to build ultimately a sustained movement, a moral movement, that will in fact continue to engage in a multifaceted way around a range of issues.
Yes, that's right. That is right.
Okay, well, I just wanted to provide an opportunity this morning to talk about it. I did give a prelude, given the origins of the original Poor People's Campaign, its goals and objectives, and to see this as a refreshing and very encouraging moment, given the overall crises that we face in these United States of America, and to frame it in moral terms is a lens that hopefully will galvanize lots of people to become active, because at the end of the day, that's what is going to, it seems to me from my perspective, carry today, is getting more and more people who engage in a culture of participation, that is the ultimate essence of democracy, is participation.
And I think it's important to say that these are very critical times, not only politically and economically, but spiritually. Like, we are really experiencing a crisis in all levels, in this country and globally. And there has also been a reawakening of consciousness. There's a lot of activity and movement that is being built. And the idea is, again, to unify those movements and have people work together in the creation of something that is sustainable and that is in the interest of all, not just us.
Okay, what about contact information for those? I'm WBAI is in the listening area in several, states, but for the greater New York area, how do people get in touch with you if they want to become involved?
So folks should email us at newyorkcitypc@gmail.com. For the next following weeks, we're going to be heading to Albany. We're actually in Albany right now, and engaging in nonviolent moral direct action. We also have events every Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday in the New York City area. In the New York State, there are other regions that are organizing. So, again, folks should definitely reach out to the New York City, spelled out, PPC@gmail.com.
So New York City, spelled out, PPC@gmail.com.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Well, we really appreciate you giving us sort of a live read as you're on location, Reverend Clyde Cumberly, as well as Reverend Claudia De La Cruz. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, we didn't get Reverend Barber, but hopefully we'll connect with him in a not too distant future. We're going to take a break here, come back, and we'll be on with Earl O'Fari Hutchinson talking about the issue of murders and fratricides in the black community. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Bonsoir, moi c'est Jeton, Naptandi Radio WBAI 99.5 FM, et puis c'est là, c'est WBAI.org. Bon radio.
Radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this.
And it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters.
Well,
it didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to a group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight.
I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, to leave Martin out of it for a moment. Martin's very rare, very great man. Martin's rare for two reasons. Part because just because he is. And because he's a real Christian, and he really believes in nonviolence. He's arrived at something in himself, which permits him, allows him to do it. And he still has great moral authority in the South. There's none whatever in the North. Poor Martin has gone through God knows what kind of hell to awaken the American conscience. But Martin has reached the end of his rope. There's some things Martin can't do. Martin's only one man. Martin can't solve the nation's central problem by himself. There are lots of people, lots of black people, I mean now, who don't go to church no more and don't listen to Martin, you know, and who anyway are themselves produced by civilization, which has always glorified violence, unless the Negro had the gun. So that Martin is undercut by the performance of the country. The country is only concerned about nonviolence if it seems that I'm going to get violent. Was I worried about nonviolence if it's some Alabama sheriff?
Jim, what do you see deep in the recesses of your own mind as the future of our nation? And I ask that question in that way because I think that the future of the Negro and the future of the nation are linked.
They're indissoluble.
Yeah. Now, what do you see? Are you essentially optimistic or pessimistic? And I really don't want to put words in your mouth because what I really want to find out is what you really believe.
Well, I'm both glad and sorry you asked me that question. I'll do my best to answer it. I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. But the Negro in this country, the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. The question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, North and South, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there's no difference in the North and the South. There's just a difference in the way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the Negro here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you got to find out why.
Well,
and the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it's able to ask that question.
As a Negro and as an American, I can only hope that America has the strength and the capacity.
The moral strength.
Okay, we're experiencing some difficulty reaching our guests today, apparently. Not usually happening with us. We were anticipating hearing from Earl O'Hara Hutchinson dealing with the issue of violence and fratricide. Actually, a couple of issues we wanted to talk to Earl about. We may yet make that connection. I don't know. He usually is very reliable. So we're waiting to see whether or not we can connect with him. I've just tried to reach out to him to see where he is this morning. He's, of course, in California, in Los Angeles with the Urban Roundtable. There are a couple of issues that he wanted to discuss. One of which is I was hoping, because I wanted to more clearly understand it. Earl is a prolific writer, author. I mean, he really churns out books at an amazing clip. Some of you may recall, I certainly remember it, and there was an exchange of emails over the weekend I was having, or he sent me an email, also sent Joe Madison, who was a talk show host on Sirius XM, and also with WOL. What is Kathy Hughes' network? I forget the network she's with. And his first book, some of you may recall, I do, because I'm ancient, is The Myth of Black Capitalism. That started Earl Ofari Hutchinson's career. The Myth of Black Capitalism, way back when. I don't know, that book must have at least been in the 70s, probably. Yeah, late 60s, early 70s. And apparently, he was showing, it was on an auction or somewhere and was selling for some incredible price. And we were having an exchange about that. But he writes books just frequently. I mean, he turns them out. Yeah, he must write four or five books a year. And he wrote a book, which was entitled On Black Lives Matter. And he did a video. In fact, it says Why Black Matters. I think it's called Why Black Lives Matter. That may be the name of the book. And he did the forthcoming book, Black Lives Do Matter. And he did a video on it. And that video was entitled Why Black Lives Do Matter. And, you know, he had a cover and everything. And Google refused to run it, saying that some of the content was inflammatory and all kinds of things. Now, subsequently, with the Urban Roundtable, which is a leadership formation, there was a request made to actually meet with the leadership of Google, at least, Facebook. Am I saying it right? Let me just make sure. Google, to meet with the leadership of Google. CEO Sundar Pichai, and they refused to meet with him. Now they are alleging again that this video is inflammatory, incendiary, and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to talk to him about that, but what's happening is, and I hope we still connect with him, since that happened, the book and orders for the book have just taken off. In fact, it's some record number of people who have signed up for the book. In fact, I'm saying here Google rejected a YouTube promotional video for the book, calling it dangerous and derogatory. It claimed that it violated its standards against inciting hate and violence. Very interesting. The meeting was solely to discuss how and why Google would censor a promo that addresses this much discussed issue of compelling racial public policy. Again, Earl was saying that since this happened, that they have actually, you know, the book has really taken off. And I wanted to include our audience in it because through social media, sometimes today, you can actually really push things in a very, very strong direction in relationship to these kinds of exclusions. So that was one issue we wanted to talk to Earl about. The second issue is one which we want to explore with him, and that's the issue of the violence and murders in our community, which is, when I did my final address at York College, I touched on maybe three areas that I thought were most pressing, that in a visceral, real way sort of grabbed and gnawed at the hearts and souls and minds of black folk, and that was gentrification. You can't go anywhere in black America where gentrification is not on the hearts and minds and lips of black people. I was in Harlem yesterday, my wife and I, and we were just traveling. I just happened to spot a particular restaurant that will remain nameless. It was very interesting because in the heart of Harlem, there was this restaurant. And You know, everybody there was non-African, put it that way. And they have a right to be there. I'm not saying that. But it's just interesting. There's obviously a place where people who are just moving in, who are not African Americans or people of African descent, sort of congregate. And it was just interesting. I said, look at this. You know, you didn't see a person of color over there. It was just all white people, really. Euro-ethnics, as Reverend Herbert Daughtry would say. But the displacement of culture, not just the displacement of people, the displacement of culture and people, to the extent that what we will have in Harlem and other places is black people will still be there, but it will only be the upper crust. It will only be the people who have means, professionals and above. Black, poor, and working people will be displaced. And the character of a Harlem, for example, as the capital, the cultural capital of black America, and one of the great sort of iconic places of black culture in the world, is threatened. In fact, it may eventually be erased. So that's an issue. No matter where you are, this is an issue that comes up. The second issue is the violence and fratricide, the murders that are taking place in the black community. Now, Chicago is one of the places that this is, you know, we've heard a lot about it. But in Baltimore, I mean, it's just a lot of places. In Baltimore, there's a murder a day. A murder a day in Baltimore. And there are other communities that are just suffering these senseless killings. There was somewhere, Washington, D.C., where we're doing actually some work. IBW is doing some work on the ground. There was a discussion that this last weekend, you know, 15 people shot, or maybe it was weekend before last, 15 people shot, 3 killed. We are in a situation where we are in an area where there is some violence and some illicit economy going on, whatever, and that's sometimes a coarse cause of some of it. And a young man who is being mentored by a formerly incarcerated person for 7 years, trying to turn his life around, had actually become a part of a advisory council for a project, a peace, justice, and safety initiative that we're trying to unfold in this part of Washington, D.C. Received a call. Within the last 3 weeks, he was killed right in the neighborhood. I mean, so this is an area of great pain. And so the discussion, and Earl, like I said, Earl Farrell Hutchinson, they experienced some. He sent a note out and said, look, this happened right in my neighborhood. Well, in this neighborhood, and I've had a similar situation occur, our family. And so the issue was, do black lives matter to black people? That's what we wanted to talk about. And it's a forum, by the way, that we held at your college, 2 years ago, I guess, now. It was well attended, and all kinds of people came out, you know, representatives of Black Lives Matter, different community groups came out who were involved. But one of the groups whom I hope we will be able to talk to later was Man Up, Andre Mitchell. And we hopefully will be able to connect with him later to talk about it. But this issue is what's going on in our communities. What? This is very, very painful. And some of it sometimes is just innocent people who, bystanders, just getting blown away. Now, in Chicago, they say now it's getting better. It's down. But it's still just too many people in black communities just taking each other out. Now, what some people say is, oh, well, white people kill each other, too. Well, that's true. But it's the randomness. This is the particularity of our turning on each other. A lot of people who were similarly situated, you know, engaged in murders. Usually those are domestic squabbles. They're things of that nature that take place, robberies and so forth. But this is a situation very often related to gang activity, the illicit economy in the community, and then it builds into grudges and retaliation. Then it becomes kind of a way of doing things, you know, almost a badge of honor. You know, even though, you know, people are losing their lives, young people, young women and men, mostly men, young men losing their lives, being a part of a family and feeling the necessity of defending themselves in a way that causes a great deal of pain for all of them. You know, those who are perpetrators, but it hurts. It is trauma in the entire community because people have to experience this and feel this agony, feel this pain in a way that is not helpful, that is in fact harmful. And so I see this as one of the real great issues that we're experiencing. So what we're going to do, having not reached Earl Afari Hutchinson, I'm going to comment a little bit more. But when we turn the corner, we're actually going to open the phones up earlier than we would have because we're going to wait until the end of the program to do that. But since this issue of do black lives matter to black people, which is intended to be provocative, frankly, to elicit your calls and your comments, when we take our next break, we come back, we're going to invite you to start the conversation. Because we don't anticipate connecting with Andre Mitchell until about 11:15, because he's on an inbound flight, and he agreed to, just as we got the people getting off the bus for the Poor People's Campaign and doing the interview, he agreed that as soon as he got off the plane, he'd be ready to chat about what's happening in East New York with Man Up Incorporated. And some of you may be from East New York, and you may want to call in and talk about what's going on in East New York in relationship to Man Up Incorporated, because they are doing a magnificent job. That they're doing it. So it is possible. I mean, they are testimony to the fact that it can be done. They have the precinct, the area that they're operating in. There was a report in the New York Times, I think 129 days or now in counting, that there had been no murders in that area. They have been on it. Now, you know, of course, and it's intensive work, and I've had the privilege of visiting with them maybe 3-4 months ago now, and I was so impressed with the way they acquit themselves and the way their program. And of course, when they came to York College, they came with a big contingent that also participated. And about 15 of them also came to my final lecture at York College as well. So this is a very, very powerful program, and we want to give people an opportunity to hear about them. Many of you already know about them, but it is a example of what can be done. But we also want to hear from you. What is the cause? Why is this happening? And to get from you what you think ought to be done. How can we overcome it? Because it is one of those areas that across the country, almost anywhere you go where there are black people, there is pain about the reality of these murders or fratricide in the black community. I use fratricide, but Dorothy Johnson Spite, whom I had on my show with Mothers in Charge from Philadelphia, she said, just stop sugarcoating it, Ron. These are murders in our community. That's what they are. And we need to face it. We need to deal with it. And we need to overcome it somehow. And so I reluctantly use the word murders in that regard, but that is true. But I call it fratricide to talk about this internal violence that is gnawing at and ripping at the sinews of our black community in a way that is not to be commended, frankly. It's something that we really have to struggle, you know, to overcome. So again, those two issues, gentrification, I think all across the country, black people are facing gentrification. And of course, this issue of violence and fratricide, you know, in our community. So we're going to take a break here, a pause for a few minutes, and we come back. In fact, I'm going to give you the phone number now that you can call on this issue of do black lives matter to black people. We'll start the conversation, and at about 11:15, we'll pick up Andre Mitchell, and then we'll continue to take your calls. I really wanted to create a lot of space this morning for the audience to call in give their perspective. 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818 is the call-in number. You can start to call now. We'll take this break, and we'll be right back.
This is Phil Donahue, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5.
Hello, I'm David Rothenberg, and I've been reviewing plays on WBAI since before you were born. And one of the joys in theater going is discovering new talent. And when I first saw Richard Holler a couple of decades back, I applauded his social passion mixed with theater excellence. Richard's latest work, E, is a portrait of a New York woman, an original, funny, outrageous, well, she's the sort of person who's comfortable with WBAI. Richard will be performing E at the Common, our downstairs neighbor at 388 Atlantic Avenue, on Sunday, June 10th at 3 o'clock, as a benefit for this listener-sponsored station. Tickets are $20 a person, and reservations for E can be made by calling 516-620-3602 or going online, give2wbai.org. Richard Holler will be performing E at the Common, 388 Atlantic Avenue, on Sunday, June 10th, 3 o'clock.
Too Raw for Radio. WBAI's monthly benefit comedy show will be on Monday, June 4th, and the first Monday of every month from here on. The show is at 7 p.m., and your $13 admission fee helps WBAI. Come for comedy, raffles, and fun. That's Monday, June 4th, at 7 p.m. for Too Raw for Radio, Comedy at the Commons, Brooklyn, located at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Just three stops from Manhattan on the A train. Too Raw for Radio, June 4th at 7 p.m.
Find us on Facebook at Too Raw for Radio, WBAI's only comedy show, June 4th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons.
Okay, we're back. Kind of rocky, rock and roll, rocky today, but that's okay. You know, this is the exception, not the rule. But we apologize for not really having Reverend Barber, who had committed to be on, and then so had Earl Afari Hutchinson. So we just, it's unusual. So, but we know how to roll. We can handle it, and we can improvise and move forward because we have a listening audience, and that's what makes it very important. So what we're going to do for the next 10 minutes or so is address this topic, do black lives matter to black people, which is what we want people to largely stick to, and then we'll connect with Andre Mitchell, and then we'll come back to the phones. I really wanted to give a lot of time today to getting people's ideas about what the issues are, what's causing it, and what we think can be used to correct it, because it is a very, very painful issue in our community. Let's go to our first caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hey, good morning, everyone. I'm Trey from the Bronx. As far as do black lives matter to black people, that would be a yes and a no.
Okay.
Yes in an abstract way. If you ask the average black person, do black lives matter to them, the average black person will say yes, of course. But on the ground, when you're hungry, the desperation, the lack of opportunities, the lack of jobs for young people, not being able to move into an apartment at the age of 30, still living at home. And these are the ones that are working. I'm not even going to deal with the ones that get a strike or two, which is what it seems like society tries to make sure you get a strike or two when they pick you up for the various things that someone of a lighter complexion would get a slap on the wrist. You get to go into the jail. You get to go into the prison system. You get to be put through the system. So, of course, during time, it makes it harder for you. So when you got desperate people that are just struggling to survive, yes, life means nothing. That's all around the world. When you go any place in the ghettos and you see desperate people, the value of life goes down significantly when you yourself have nothing to live for. That's what I see.
Right, right. And what do you see? Very, 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 very penetrating analysis. And what do you see as, what do you think we should be doing as black people to try to address it? What should government be doing? What are your, and do you see any hope?
There's every day you wake up is hope. Okay, as long as you can wake up and move your body and use your mind, there's a possibility out there. Is it bleak? Yes. Does it look good? No. But we have the opportunity to make something happen. I'm just watching the money that we spent with that Black Panther. Mm-hmm. Okay. That money went to Disney. I can't imagine if we spent half of that and just gave ourselves 1 year. We said, okay, we got 1 year to set up this fund where we're going to have training for the youth. They're going to have apprenticeships. They're going to learn how to become electricians. They're going to learn how to become anything they want, because there are so many jobs where you do not have to have a college degree to make $100,000 a year.
That's true.
But they don't talk about this in these schools.
Right.
I don't know what they're doing in these schools, but they don't talk about it.
Right.
So if we could formulate money, we have the money, and start our own programs for these young people. Once they start to see a future for themselves, once you put hope in somebody's life, they're going to put the gun down.
Right.
But if I don't have any hope,
right?
I mean, you know, that's what life is about. I mean, even animals, when you give something no hope, it lashes out at anything and everything. And usually the closest things to you. And the closest things to you is another black person that's poor, not some rich person on Fifth Avenue living in a penthouse. Right. They're not the closest thing to you.
Right. Let me ask you this question. Are you sound like someone who's, you know, have thought about these things a great deal. Are you involved? Do you have an organization? Or are you engaged? Or just tell me a little bit about your work.
Oh, my goodness. Well, my work is through the streets. Unfortunately, I went through the School of Hard Knocks. I learned the hard way. I was on this show, Locked Up Abroad, and I did a lot of outreach after that show to youth through different programs. But I am not, I can't say I'm hooked up to any large firm that deals with that. I'm just a hands-on type person, and when I meet people, I try to encourage them in any way I can.
Right.
So that's what I'm doing.
Right. Well, I really appreciate your perspective. I really do, and I could tell by the way you were thinking about this issue that you're thoughtful and you're not just complaining about it. You're trying to find ways to...
Oh, definitely. We have to. It's more, like I said, as long as there's life, you know, the possibilities are there. The options are there. We just have to make use of these options. We have to believe that we can do it. And when I saw the money, like I said, when I saw the money we spent in just a short period of time for that movie, just give ourselves 1 year.
Right.
And all across the country, we could have, in each state, in each city, we could have places where these young people can go and learn and get themselves an opportunity to make a life for themselves, because that's what they want.
Right.
That's what they need.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to leave it there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, my brother. Really appreciate it. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Again, the discussion is, do black lives matter to black people? We're talking about an issue that I think strikes a nerve in almost any black community. You go anywhere in the country, you find this is an area that just people are just grappling with and but seemingly almost somewhat paralyzed by it too, because it just gnaws at the heart and soul of black people that we have, you know, these tragic circumstances with our young people, mostly our young people, you know, in our community. And you know, there are young sisters and brothers. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, this is Omar from the Bronx. How are we doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Do black lives matter to black people? What we getting through all of the mediums, through TV, everything Black Lives is being patterned to live vicariously through is through everything else that's not Black, if you can follow and understand what I mean by that. We're the only group that's always being shown how to integrate and be or conform with another group. We have our own swag. We have our own style. We have our own way of doing things. It gets stolen. It gets taken. Mm-hmm. It gets colonized and abused by others. And then they don't give it back. And then we're just left with, you know, we're just Black. Do Black lives matter to Black people? At the end of the day, yes, I love my family. Something happens to them and they go out into the street, I'm going to be very, very devastated if something happens to them. However, something just happened recently to a young girl around the neighborhood. Innocent shot. Innocent bystander, about 17, 18 years old. It was all on the news. Lambert Houses has been talked about in the last 2-3 days. It just happened not too long ago. There was another kid that just got killed, a family friend of mine, and she just buried her son. So we put in these situations where we constantly at each other's neck. We constantly scrounging for peanuts. And like the other caller, the previous caller just before me said, he hit it right on the head. Who are you next to when it's time to lash out? You right next to Black people. So the same thing needs to be said. Do Asian lives matter to Asian people? Do Puerto Rican lives matter to Puerto Rican? Do white lives matter to white people? You're going to affect where you live at. So if I live in a Puerto Rican neighborhood and I'm Puerto Rican, I'm not killing another white person. So does Puerto Rican lives matter to Puerto Rican people? Of course they do. But now you got to look at the situation and why he's doing what he's doing to that next Puerto Rican, to that next Black man, so forth and so on throughout the whole thing. You follow what I'm saying?
I do. I absolutely do.
You kind of like get the gist of where I'm going, because at the end of the day, all lives matter. And I'm not taking away from the Black Lives Matter when they used to say that and mix it up and be like, oh, well, all lives matter. No. When they were saying Black Lives Matter, they were saying that for a specific reason to what was going on throughout the country and as far as what we were getting the short end of the stick on. However, all lives do matter in the sense that if I live in a white neighborhood and I go kill white people, all those white people in the neighborhood should be like, nah, that dude's life mattered that you just took. And the same thing go throughout all of the nations in this country. So, I mean, when we point out ours just get so blown up because of our predicament we're in. We're the poorest demographic in the country. You know, we're the highest incarcerated rate. You understand what I'm saying? As far as illnesses and diseases and all that, as far as coverage go, we got the worst coverage when it comes to it. So, I mean, we at the bottom of the barrel of it. And you know what's funky? And I'm going to close on this because I know you got some more callers on the back end. You know what's funny? Everything that was legislated for us back in the 60s with King and all of them and Civil Rights Act with LBJ, every other quote-unquote minority outside of Black people, they're benefiting from it more so than Black people today.
That's true.
And I'm going to just end on that, man.
All right. Thank you. Really, really appreciate your comments.
You got it.
All right. Okay, hopefully we're going to be reaching out also to Andre Mitchell and trying to connect with him. In the meantime, we'll take another call. 347-335-0818. Really appreciate the calls so far. 347-335-0818, your perspective on this issue of do Black lives matter to Black people. As he was just pointing out, here's an innocent. This is the kind of thing that hurts. I mean, you don't want to see anybody hurt. But here's somebody, just a 17-year-old girl. She just, I mean, she ain't got nothing to do with it. Whatever the spat is, whatever the argument is between the beef, she's not in it, but she's dead. And that's because for the people who have the beef with each other, their lives don't matter to each other. But in the process, that means nobody's life matters because there's a sense of recklessness. There's a sense of what Cornel West calls nihilism in the community, where it just everything is everything. And once, by the way, some of these young people who are committed, they get pulled out of it, they're remorseful. They're not lost. It's not, I'm not condoning what they're doing, but I'm saying they've been put in this condition, and as a result, these things happen. But once they get pulled out of it, you know, then, you know, they are often remorseful. They see what they've done. There's a need for us to figure out a way to do some healing you know, in our communities. Let's see if we have another caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
How you doing, Mr. Ron Daniels?
I'm doing fine.
My name is Dan also, and I'm calling from the Bronx. Okay, I would like to relate kind of a religious experience. No, a spiritual experience, excuse me. 11 years old, Malcolm X was killed, and we were living in Harlem. All the adults heard about it on the radio, and they bolted out the house. So I was the only one inside, thinking, what a moment. After that, I laid on my mom's bed, just thinking 11-year-old stuff. And all of a sudden, right in front of my eyes, which I thought was on my forehead, was a vision of three vivid colors, orange, green, and metallic blue. All right, forget that. I mean, I forgot that all the way. Next thing I see it in 2008, orange, green, metallic blue. After that, didn't know what it was about. Forget it again. Seeing the astrological destiny of the black race, a YouTube video that says how the state we're in is because they have usurped the statues of the heavens. Now, the heavens is really black. Mm. So while we're killing each other, we're thinking, oh, man, we just messed up naturally as a people. So Adams is the basis of all of life, not Adam. So after being told Adam, we figure we roll with that. So it's really what we don't see, the Adam. And we're all made up of Adam. And so that usurping of the laws of heaven, statutes of heaven, is a twisting, as in retrograde, having it slowed down as compared to be going backwards. And that said, we don't know all about what each other's going to do, which is each other is going to think, but we're killing each other as the opposite of what we once loved to watch, Soul Train, just watch ourselves do our thing. Now so it's the opposite. Marvin said, what's going on? He couldn't put his finger on it. Okay, so the basis of those colors is the planet as the living righteousness. The earth doesn't move. I mean, the earth is moving. The sun doesn't move and go up and come down. So what's happening with that is the numbness of not feeling Earth is like the numbness of how many people have been on this planet, and numbers don't end. It's just numb. So to rectify that is to connect ourselves with those three colors, orange as the sun, green as the whole planet, the bounty, and the metallic blue is the sun evening with the Earth. And making that wonderful color in the sky to look like there's no more wars on the planet. And our connection is the solar plexus to the solar system, and that being the roof of the mouth. As Arsenio Hall once said, the roof is on fire. Mm. Now, Public Enemy said, bring the noise. Now, to make noise not be just noise, the result will be the headache, the top all headaches. Infuriating, can't stand it. So to go in front of the ruling classes and even march through the neighborhoods with these colors on the roof of the mouth is our spiritual inheritance of when will there be a harvest for the world.
Right. All right.
I got papers on this.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it. Appreciate your assessment and your formula. Thank you so much for calling. Really appreciate it. 347-335-0818. We got some open lines. 347-335-0818. Bronx has been coming in strong. Bronx has been in the house. 347-335-0818. We'll get you into the conversation. Do Black Lives Matter to Black People? Again, very thoughtful commentaries so far. Three brothers have called. There's some sisters out there. Get some sisters into this conversation. What you think is going on as well. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Oh, yes. This is Lee calling from the Bronx.
Good.
What I would like to do is hook up with the gentleman that came on the air first this morning.
Right.
Because I think together we can do some things.
Yeah, that's why I thought he was very thoughtful and laying out his concerns, his optimism, his hopefulness, and I don't know quite how to connect, and I have
an idea.
Okay, go ahead.
I can leave my information. If he's listening, perhaps he'll call and get it from you guys.
Okay, well, if you're willing to do that, fine. I certainly, you know, I don't want to leave you open to a whole bunch of people calling you, but if you're open to doing that, that's fine.
Okay, you want to take it offline? Could I hold on?
Well, I can't. I'm not. I don't have a capacity to do that. If you actually email, if you email us to the WBAI website, then I can pick it up that way, and we can make the exchange that way.
Okay, I can do that.
All right, that'll be good. Appreciate your call. All right, this people want to connect. I like that because I think if we can come together, we can also work on some things. And she was saying she, you know, first I wanted to hear a woman's voice in the conversation, a sister's voice, and we were great, glad to get that because we'd have to connect and work on these things, you know. And we can't just sit back. We've got to be able to touch some folk, and I think touching is important. When I say touch, I mean in terms of working to make lives better. But in some ways, it's actually reaching out to people. I mean, making a emotional, intellectual, spiritual connection with folks. And to some degree, we've lost that. And we've let a generation just sort of feel isolated, feel abandoned. And in that abandonment, because some of us have been, quote unquote, successful, prosperous, whatever that might be, not realizing that none of us will rise among the least of us. And so we really, really need to really focus time on making those reconnections. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Let's see, do we have another caller? Good morning, you're on Vantage Point.
Good morning, can I be heard?
Yes, you can be heard. Where are you calling from? Is it more Bronx?
I'm calling from East Orange, New Jersey. Richard from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
All right, okay. We had to break up that Bronx thing. The Bronx was dominating.
Yes, I know that. I used to be in the Bronx with a girlfriend of mine. I was on University Avenue, 166th Street, back in 1971, 2 and 3.
All right, okay.
Okay. Yes, I'm calling. At the age of 17, I met Muhammad Ali down at the Madison Square Garden across from the garden with the hotel. And I was a Seventh-day Adventist at the time, and I asked him some questions about the Christianity, and he told me, brother, don't believe the lie they taught you. He said, go up to number 7, temple number 7, and hear Stephen Mr. Farquhar, and you'll get to understand the truth of the black man. And how, you know, this planet Earth that we was once the landlords of, we just got a temporary landlord at the present time. So I went up and I heard what the minister had to say. And I'm going to share this with you. I was born in the church. I left the church in 1972 and went straight up to temple number 7 and accepted Jesus of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, along with Stephanie Mills' sister, Audrey Mills. Don't forget, we accepted at the same time, March 21st, 1973. And the reason I mentioned that, because just 2 days ago, you know, Mr. Louis Farquhar's son, Louis Farquhar
right.
Jr., passed away
two days
ago from a heart attack.
Yes, I just got the word last
night. And him and I were very close, because after Stephanie Mills had went into the music world, they asked her to abandon him, so that her musical career will move on, because anyone associated with what they call an anti-Semitic. So he went through a whole lot of hardship, but that I gave him good advice and told him, brother, life moves on, these things happen. I'm going to bring it up to date to what the Lama Lama taught us. And he said to us, he said, a lot of y'all may reject me because you don't want to give up smoking cigarettes, eating pork, and you just don't want to give up a whole lot of negative things you really don't need. He said, but in the end, even if I'm not here, all of y'all are going to turn around and say, you know what, Mr. Muhammad was right, because he said, for not listening to me, he said, God promised he's going to turn the white man loose on you. You're going to swear he's trying to put you back on the plantation. And Donald Trump is that man that God is using to make black people realize we either better do it for self and go back and listen to what Mr. Muhammad taught us, or else we're going to perish. The preachers don't have to answer. The black politicians sold out. Because they saw what was coming with the re-gentrification, but they took the money and looked the other way. From Chuck Engel down to the local congressmen and council people, they sold out. I know this for a fact. Mm. So what I'm saying is, oh, and the name, by the way, we are not a race. The black man is not a race. Mr. Muhammad said we are a nation within a nation. We're not a race. Everybody else, like the Caucasian, he's a race, but you have the brown nation, which is the Japanese, the yellows, the Chinese. We are the first people of the planet. So we're not a third world. We are first world people. The Caucasians are a third world because they're the last people on the planet.
So you're suggesting that, to sort of cut to the chase, that your embrace for you, your embrace of Islam under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was a saving grace and something that you believe is important in terms of ending the violence and fratricide in our community.
Well, if you follow the teachers, and let me share this. I was working for a Mason, which was a Caucasian, who hired me back in 1979. Let me share something with you. He said, your people that came here, the ones that we kidnapped and brought here, he said, mostly the majority of them were Muslims. They didn't want anybody with bones in their noses and plates in their mouth. They said, we wanted the most advanced black people out of West Africa, especially West Africa, because your people had talents. Benjamin Banneker came from West Africa, Mali. And we know the talents that he had in designing Washington, D.C. I mean, I won't say he came from Africa, but his family came from Mali. And he had skills in astrology, astronomy, and agriculture. All right? So most of my people, I trace my roots back to my father came from Barbados. My mother's mother came from Barbados with Arawak Indian roots. And their origin came from Guinea. And we were builders. So the first black people they brought here, they used us to help build this country. We had skills.
Oh, yeah, history, no question about that. But the point is, knowing that history is, I think, just my own perspective, is also an important part of it. To the degree to which we do not know our history, we do not know these roots.
That's the problem.
All right, look, appreciate your call. We want to get some other calls in, but we appreciate your perspective as well, calling all the way from East Orange, New Jersey. We really appreciate it. Let's get other callers in at 347-335-0818. Do Black Lives Matter to Black People? The issue of fratricide violence, murders in the black community, how do we overcome it? What is the cause and how do we overcome it is what we're talking about. We have lines open for your conversation on this matter. We had some disconnect with Earl Afari Hutchinson, who's emailing to say we had some technical problems. But Earl is a good brother, and we'll get him back on at some point in terms of dealing with these issues. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Yes. Hi. I admire so much what you're doing and what you have done. My name is Kagiso. I think that Black lives do matter. You know, just seeing it in the smiles and the eye contact of brothers and sisters when you're walking down the street, seeing the accomplishments that we have done. But I think in terms of, I don't think we have done enough for the youth. I think I'm 76 years old, and I was in the movement for a long time. And I don't think we taught the youth what it was, taught the youth our history and what it is to be black in this country. And we didn't teach them our African roots. We didn't teach them our history within this country. And so they don't have a background. And then we're just a microcosm of the craziness of what's going on in this country. So with the social media, you know, our youth hear all this other stuff, and they don't know how to connect. And so we need to really pull them in. I am part of an organization which is a art school, but we're more than an art school. It's Mind Builders Creative Arts Center in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And we teach dance and music and teen drama and folk culture, but it's loving the children. We're like a family, and we try to teach them to be proud of themselves, to know themselves, and I think that's what we have to do. We need to have more of these groups in every corner. I mean, in the Bronx, you know, sort of like a wasteland, we don't have that many groups that are addressing the children's needs, right. And that's what we need to do.
Right.
You know.
Well, we're glad you're engaged, and we talked about gentrification. Don't say we want to mix the subject up, but there was a big article about how gentrification is getting ready to take over the, particularly some of the areas of the Bronx that were seen as non-desirable, the South Bronx, and said gentrification is getting ready to take over big time. So we have this issue wherever we go. We are facing gentrification and also this issue of internal fratricide. Thank you so much for the work that you do, and keep on keeping on. And I think you're on the right track. So we need more people to spend time in programs like this, cultural, creative, artistic programs that are not art for art's sake, but also have the objective of helping to create self-esteem, teach history, and have our young people have a stronger sense of themselves. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a brief break and come right back and continue to take your calls so you can continue to line up at 347-335-0818. I am enjoying this exchange of information because that's what I really like more than anything else, is interaction with the audience. Ideas. Do black lives matter to black people? We'll be right back to continue that conversation after we take this break.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Hello, I'm David Rothenberg, and I've been reviewing plays on WBAI since before you were born. And one of the joys in theater-going is discovering new talent. And when I first saw Richard Holler a couple of decades back, I applauded his social passion mixed with theater excellence. Richard's latest work, E, is a portrait of a New York woman, an original, funny, outrageous, well, she's the sort of person who's comfortable with WBAI. Richard will be performing E at the Common, our downstairs neighbor at 388 Atlantic Avenue, on Sunday, June 10th at 3 o'clock, as a benefit for this listener-sponsored station. Tickets are $20 a person, and reservations for E can be made by calling 516-620-3602 or going online give2wbai.org. Richard Holler will be performing E at the Common, 388 Atlantic Avenue on Sunday, June 10th, 3 o'clock.
Okay, really, really, really wonderful conversation today. The fact that some of our guests we've misconnected with has been a blessing in disguise, because I really, frankly, in much of the radio I've done many over the years, you know, I just open the phones and have a conversation with the audience. I really enjoy that, frankly, and around topics like this. And let me just suggest, too, that people can also go to our website, ibw21.org. ibw21.org, and we encourage you to sign up for our newsletter, because there is work that we'll be doing, continue to do here in New York, and we're doing work around the country, and in some ways also trying to address some of these issues in the work that we do as well. So again, you can follow us ibw21.org. That's the website, ibw21.org. In fact, later this month, I'm going to a gun violence summit in Los Angeles with a major faith organization that is dealing with it. One of the things I'm very proud about in terms of Newark, because many of you know we're doing this Newark initiative, is the degree to which Roz Baraka, the Honorable Roz J. Baraka, mayor there, has been working to reduce the violence in the community. And it is working, but it is working in a way that the first caller and others have suggested. They're also trying to put some jobs out there, some economic development. But I believe that you also have to have that cultural component. That's just my belief. Jobs, yes, I believe in rites of passage programs. I think we really have got to rebuild the inner systems of our people that have been destroyed by white supremacy, have been destroyed by these positions that we've been put in. We've got to heal ourselves internally. And so I always think that that cultural content, that African-centered education, is a critical part of the formula. But so go to our website, ibw21.org, sign up for the newsletter so that we will be getting the stream of information about some of the work that we're doing as well. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes. Hi. My name is Michelle from Brooklyn.
Yes.
And just to relate to your topic of discussion, you know, we as black people, really need to come together at this point. I think the biggest problem we have is our lack of unity. And the reason for that, you know, there are multiple reasons, and I understand that, with the main one being slavery. You know, we were torn apart from our families and, you know, segregated and things like that. But at this point, we're in 2018 now, and the lack of unity that we have is horrendous. I mean, all the other groups of people, all the other races, they stick together. You know, even if they don't agree with everything or don't get along, or, you know, they have different social, economic levels, different classes, they still try to, you know, come together to some extent. We're the only group of people who are looked down so much upon. But we have to realize, like, that says a lot. Why are we hated so much? Why are we oppressed? Why do they want to wipe us out so much? Because we have something unique. We have great qualities and gifts. It's obviously something that they're very afraid of. So we are a powerful people in ourselves. We have something. It's something about us that the masses, the powers that be, can't stand or tolerate or want or are envious of. And when we realize how great and powerful we truly are, we can come together and build our own economy, you know, our own infrastructures. We can do for ourselves and our communities, and we don't have to look for people outside for jobs and education and things of that nature. We have to heal, but we've been healing for a long time. And like one of the other callers said, you know, a lot of it deals with the youth, too, because us older folks are going to pass away sooner or later. We have to teach our children how to be, how to behave, how to think, how to, you know, have confidence and self-esteem, how to be leaders. And you know, it just... it starts with each family individually. We have to even talk to kids on the street. Sometimes I just walk around and talk to the young people, like, you know, how are you? What's going on? And, you know, I know it's hard out here, but you gotta believe in yourself and build up your self-esteem and try and, you know, things like that. We have to encourage one another. And
right.
Sometimes I support businesses. I know I'm being ripped off, or, you know, I know that the person may have been disrespectful. And I'm talking about people of color, the businesses that are out there. I don't even care sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just go to the bodega that's owned by the black person, even though they're not a whole lot in my community. But I go out of my way to go there, even though they may not have everything I want. I just want to support my people. I'm tired of putting my money outside to businesses and establishments where the people don't give a damn about me, or they don't like me, right, or they disrespect me, you know. We have to support each other. We have to respect each other. We have to come together. We have to love each other in spite of our differences. We know that nobody's going to get along and agree on everything, but we have a common problem. They are trying to, they're destroying us. They are killing us every day.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. Are there any projects or programs that you see in the community that you think are doing a good job in terms of trying to promote either economic development, education, cultural awareness, youth development?
Well, when I drive down Church Avenue in Brooklyn, I see the organizations, Gangsters Making Astronomical Differences in the community. That's their name, the logo or what have you. So, you know, I see some, you know, programs for the youth.
Right.
They're not, you know, like all over the place, but I mean, they're out there. They're out there. A lot of times we don't know, you know, what they are or where they're located. But yeah, I do see some.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that we have to do is continue to do what you're doing, and that is in your own way as you encourage young people, and then point them to those programs. You know, point them to those programs. And then through our churches, civic groups, and so forth, sometimes we look elsewhere when it's the actions that you take, and you're already taking those actions, then combining with friends or with family to create, even if it's a small program, to save two, three, four, five. You know, I think that's the way you have to go. So
we have to start somewhere, and it doesn't matter how small it is. It's the contribution that we're making, and if we all are doing something to that degree, whether it's big or small, eventually, you know, the change is going to come. But we just have to start and stop looking at, you know, the problems or the differences that we have. We have a bigger problem as black people overall. It doesn't matter what my level of education, how much money I make, where I live, the suburbs, the ghetto. We are all black, and we are fighting this plight. And it, you know, we are not winning right now. I can't even believe that we are still here. That's how extraordinary we are. These people have been trying to kill us since the beginning of time, and we're still here. We are an extraordinary, amazing people, and we just sitting back. I'm not saying all of us, of course, I'm generalizing, but you know what I mean. Right. It's too many of us that are just lacking and not looking at it for what it is. We have to come together no matter what.
All right, that's a good place. Nice emphasis. Thank Appreciate you. Your inspirational message. Others can call at 347-335-0818. Very positive callers today. Very positive. And I think that's in and of itself is valuable. I mean, we've got to build. You got to start somewhere. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. Each of us in our own way can do things. Some of it's broad public policy advocacy. Some of it's working with organizations. And there are lots of organizations out there. That's why, again, I wanted to connect with Man Up. I guess I'll have to try to reach them next week, apparently. I know that, and many of you know Andre Mitchell, he was coming back into the city. I don't know whether his plane was delayed or whatever. But all of it has worked out, really, because we really had an opportunity to have more interaction with the callers today than I normally would, because I really enjoy this interaction, because I think we have to be solution-oriented, and we have to be optimistic. We don't have to be, like, bland and just sort of act like nothing's going on in our community. There are things that are going on. But then to the degree that we can point to things that are working or where people are striving, then we need to connect with those things too, by the way. We need to not just look at the problem. We need to address the problem by linking up with others who are trying to solve the problem. And, you know, it may be difficult for all of us to agree on everything all the time, but cluster with that group of people that you do agree with. Just start there. 5 people, 10 people, 2 or 3 organizations. We do a lot of that with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. That's what we do all over the country. You know, we have situations where we have these justice collaboratives, organizations in Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and Pittsburgh. We pull groups together that have not been working with each other, 15, 20, 25 organizations every 3 months, Pan-African Unity Dialogue, Black Family Summit. That's what we work on, pulling groups together to work on these issues. 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning. I would just like to say this to those people who are marching that says all lives matter. That is true, but where they need to march is to the Congress and to the police stations. And another point I would like to make is for that unity to come about, you have to know yourself, you know. That is, know your culture, know your history, and then you unite, you get some land, and take care of yourself. The land will produce everything you need. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Okay. Really, really appreciate those observations. Man, it's been very positive. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Again, having a conversation, do black lives matter to black people? Again, 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Well, we have an open line. We have open lines, 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Thank you. You know, my name is Allah's Archangel Melchizedek, the Green Room from the Holy City of Newark, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, it was a picture of a great big black man, powerful. He had that. He said, he was, you know, he said, "You have taken the chains off my legs and off my hand. Can you take them off my brain?"
It said, "Off your mind." That's right.
And the problem we got is idolatry to a degree, because we think you can't do them unless my fool's got the hand in it. That's a lie. He copies you, Pharaoh, president. When you get there, one thing they're going to have to get out of their minds, very simple. Very simple indeed. Total and complete separation between the white race and the divine entity, or mankind and man. You'll be able to build your own institutions. You know, you're not going to sell that bread to that woman for that much. You have to cut it down on 75%. You'll be able to structure your own spiritual essence and environment without contamination from another. A friend of mine came up to me. He said, "Did you read about Adolf Hitler?" I said, "Yeah, I've been reading about him for years. He was a peasant. The peasants didn't like the farmers. You know, the peasants in Germany did not like those who manipulated their crops to their benefit and to the destruction of the peasants." So he said, "Well, he has another book out." I said, "He does?" He said, "Yes, the Dinner on Conversation of Adolf Hitler." And he was talking in there, Adolf Hitler was talking about contamination, because he said the outside entities of the world were contaminating the German people. And that's one problem we got.
Hold on a minute.
You're not going to put that among our people because of this, that. We don't have no filtering process to say yes and no.
Yeah, but
in our own civilization, we would.
Yeah, but I don't want to use Adolf Hitler as the example. That desire not to contaminate.
Adolf, he's more famous than Alexander the Greek, and they don't study them more.
Well, I'm not even
when you go to the butcher market and you see a piece of meat and it got fat on it, a butcher done cut that out from a steer. You cut out what is correct and you keep what's correct and throw the fat away.
Yeah,
Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf is a very interesting book.
Yeah, it is an interesting book, and that book led to the destruction of 12 million people and the desire to cut out the fat. And I don't think we want to use that particular example in that model. That's all I'm saying. I agree with you that we need to talk about how do we stress positive values. I'm not so much interested in this whole notion of race purity, frankly, because race is a construct that white people created in the first place. So I'm not interested in perpetuating that conversation. I'm saying that as we see different cultures and ethnicities and so forth, and we as people of African descent, you know, need to talk about historically as we have evolved, what have been our values? What have been the systems that have sustained us? That's why Dr. Mylana Karinga created the notion of Kawa Ida and the seven principles of the black value system. And he created Kwanzaa. So that if we look at those seven principles and those values, that's how we separate the lean from the fat, not in terms of some concepts of pure people and imperfect people in that thing. I understand where you're trying to go with it, but I just think that referencing Hitler is not the best way to go. Look, appreciate your call. Got to create space for others. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. We just have a few more minutes left. I'd like to get a couple more callers in. I have so enjoyed this. And, you know, we need to have these kinds of conversations. We need to have town hall meetings. We need to, and I'm sure groups are doing this. So I'm just trying to contribute a few ideas to that process. And I like to use Vantage Point as a way of also doing that. That's why almost every program I try to leave at least the last few minutes, the last 20 minutes, just for us to talk to each other. And I'm sure those conversations are taking, I'm just adding to it. I'm not trying to act as if we're the only ones doing these things, because we're not. 347-335-0818. Always affirm the positive. Keep affirming the positive. Look for it. Look for the good and praise it. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Helen. I'm from Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy.
Yes.
Am I on the? Am I online right now?
Yes, you are. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. It's Helen. Helen from Bed-Stuy.
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, talk to us. We want to hear your ideas.
Okay. So, I feel all lives matter, of course, and you know, there's only one race, which is the human race, and I understand that the issues of whether black people believe that Black Lives Matter is a concern, and I totally agree. I agree that all lives matter. Black lives matter. Now, it's a question of seeking a solution. Everybody has held an opinion on, you know, how do we reach the point where we resolve these ongoing issues, which have been ongoing for hundreds of years. The solution is what has to be challenged, because this has to be overcome. And my feeling is that if we were to basically challenge the social norms by boycotting the system itself, we would definitely have an impact on how they're going to respond. The government, the cities, the states, how everyone is being treated. They're going to have to respond. It's not enough to say, you know, to just basically march across town, no peace, no justice. That has not made allowances for us to get to the point that we need to get to. If we were to definitely boycott the system by not riding their subways, their buses, shopping in their stores, we would hurt their pockets. And I think that monetarily, our society is so big and so hung up on profit that we've become very numb to connecting as human beings. Everything is about money out here. Right. Nothing else matters.
Right. Okay, we're running out of time. I happen to would like to explore that more, because I'm a strong proponent of economic sanctions, of boycotts. However, there's a science to it, and we can't, in my judgment, boycott everything at one time. We've got to figure out specific targets and be able to address that. So thank you much. Really appreciate your call. Okay, folks, well, we've had a really, really, really vigorous and productive and constructive dialogue this morning. Really, really appreciate it. And we'd like to have more of these conversations in terms of today. We were talking about, do black lives matter to black people, because of the murders and the genocide, fratricide, not genocide, that's going on internally in our community, and how we can address that. And I think we've had a lot of very, very positive suggestions about how to move forward. We'll try to make some adjustments and maybe continue this conversation next week, because we certainly wanted to get Man Up on the air, because they have been able to programmatically address this issue in the areas that they work on in East New York over now. It must be 150, 160 days and counting. Been very effective. And so we'd like to know what they do, and maybe that can be emulated, because that's the other thing. Sometimes we don't know the programs that are going on, so therefore we say that nothing is happening when there are things that are happening. We say that we need to unify when there are some people who are unifying and are working diligently to continue those efforts. Again, I commend you to the IBW website, IBW21.org, IBW21.org, to see what we're doing with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And for those of you who want to connect with the Poor People's Campaign, it is New York City, written out, New York City PPC. @gmail.com. That's New York City PPP, which stands for Poor People's Campaign, @gmail.com. So we really want you to connect with that. And don't forget to become a WBAI buddy, so we can have these kind of conversations. You know, I was told you about the station I was out in Colorado. They gave me that little, I almost said, forget it. I don't want to be on there for 2 minutes talking when I interview. You know, we've had a period of time to get our callers engaged, a lot of good suggestions, because this is supported by you, and that's why we're able to do it. So for $10, just $10, you become a WBAI buddy. Go to give2wbai.org and do it by credit card or by your checking account. And hey, We'll see you again next week. Enjoyed it here on Vantage Point.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it. And I love that. I have to
celebrate you. There are too many men that are suffering from hypertension. There are too many men that suffer from diabetes.
Say that.
There are too many men that suffer from depression.
Say that.
And we have too much violence in our community. All right, so now is the time that we stand up as men and say no more. All right. Man up! Man up! Join us June the 14th. We will be having an event here at the hospital to make all men in our community aware of what they need to do to make themselves healthy, protect themselves, and protect their family. Thank you so much for coming out, guys. All right.
WBAI New York. That's Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels, Mondays at 10 a.m. Well, we're back to our regular programming schedule. My name is Michael G. Haskins, by the way. We're back to our regular programming schedule and thank all of you for contributing during our spring fundraising and membership drive. And you can make a contribution again at any time that BAI buddy that Ron was talking about, becoming a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. You can do that as well. Visit the website, WBAI.org. I just want to say one thing about the callers that just left the air a moment ago. Two things. One, earlier in the phone call segment, there's a young woman that called in and said that she wanted to work with somebody in the Bronx, and but was reluctant, or we were reluctant, or Ron was reluctant to have her give her phone number out over the air. I did manage to get her off the air and get an email address. It's BevFraser999@gmail.com. BevFraser999@gmail.com. Bev, I think I've gotten it right. Bev, FRASER 999. At Gmail. If I didn't get it right, you'll correct me, and you can make contact with that individual from the Bronx. The other caller who called back as we were having, Ron Daniels was having that spirited discussion with the callers, Omar called back again. And, you know, we try to make space for new callers, new voices. So Omar called back and said, you know, I'm sorry, but I want to get back in. And I asked him, Omar, would you just step back and allow some different voices? We want to try to get as many people as we can on the program with Ron Daniels this morning. You know what Omar said? Omar said, respect. Okay, no problem. Hung up the phone to make way for your phone call. And I think that's a wonderful thing. What a positive affirmation of what we're trying to do here at WBAI. And it's made all of this, it's made possible because of you. We have to reach back and make that connection with the community again. We've gotten away from it the past, you know, that's debatable, but we can do it. We can do it together. Listener-sponsored WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. What a radio station we have. And